Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Andy Nowicki. Andy is an author of 8 books and the co-editor of The Alternative Right. He is also the host of The Nameless Podcast. Andy, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing very well, Tim, and I'm very happy to be back on your show. Thanks for having me back.
Well, the last time we talked, I believe, is back in January or February. We discussed your book about the reptilian ruling elite, the reptilian mindset of the ruling class. And also we discussed the problem of elite pedophilia. And I suspect that'll come up again in tonight's discussion, because we'll be talking about Pizzagate. But a lot has transpired since then. Of course, we had Trump's upset victory over Hillary Clinton in the presidential election. So what do you make of the incoming Trump administration, some of the choices he has made for his cabinet? And what does a Trump presidency mean to the alt-right?
Well, as far as what it means for the alt-right, I find it my whole take on Trump and the alt-right might be a little different than some people's, because I mean, and as you say, I guess in some way affiliated with the alt-right. I'm the assistant editor of the website entitled Alternative Right. So I've been affiliated with that website, you know, in its prior incarnation and what it became afterwards in 2013, late 2013, when it was reborn and Richard Spencer started the Radix Journal magazine. Prior to that, Alternative Right was Richard Spencer's thing. He was the editor and so forth. And no, it's been really, really interesting to see the alt-right sort of dragged out of the dark and into the light this past year. It's been an extraordinary year in so many ways. But I think that it seems to me that the reason why the alt-right became a thing to whatever extent it is a thing in the popular culture or whatever in the public consciousness, which I don't know. I think that maybe you stop 10 people on the street, let's say 100 people on the street, and ask them if they know about the alternative right. I'm not sure how many of them will say they have heard of it. Like maybe 5 or 6 out of 100 would be my guess. I mean, so if we're talking about, the real kind of impact that it's had on, when we get out to real mass culture level, I don't know if it's that prominent, so we shouldn't get carried away. But I would say that it has become a thing in the sense that it's what people are talking about, and the press is talking about it. And you type alt-right or alternative right into any search engine, and every day different articles come up. 98 to 100% of them very negative and and most of them rather unfair and even slanderous. But even so, it's getting plenty of attention. And it seems to me that how this happened was, you know, the alt-right, many segments of the alt-right rallied behind Trump because they liked his anti-immigration stance, and they just sort of saw him as a quote-unquote shitlord, as they're called. And that's from the alt-right perspective, that's a positive term. He's, you know, like this guy who doesn't take crap and, you know, isn't whipped by the feminists and others. You know, he's sort of an alpha type of guy. And so they were sort of enraptured by his whole personality, his aura, and the fact that he was touching on this subject of illegal immigration and also to some extent, you know, protectionism, both of which are things that generally, especially illegal immigration, you don't go there. Although there are plenty of people in America who are upset about the, you know, open border and illegal aliens or immigrants coming in and nobody seeming to care about border security and the replacement of Western culture by third worlders being ushered in, you know, because of the machinations of the elites. This is something that makes a lot of people angry in the United States. But of course, both political parties are, to some extent or other, controlled by Wall Street, and Wall Street and, you know, major corporations are generally very supportive of, you know, globalism and open borders. And so it's a thing that, generally speaking, politicians don't touch on that heavily. But Trump, at least early on, you know, hit it really, really hard. And, you know, I'm cynical, and I was sort of thinking, come on, this guy's been in the public eye since the 80s. I mean, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when Trump was first on the scene, you know, in the Art of the Deal, you know, Reagan 80s era, Lifestyles of the Rich and the Famous kind of era. And, you know, he's around for, what, 3-4 decades in the public eye, and all of a sudden he's this major anti-immigration guy, and he's never been known to have any kind of stance about illegal immigration before. I mean, I sort of saw it as opportunism, and I still sort of see it that way. But it's still interesting, and Trump is interesting as a phenomenon because, you know, he's, I guess, able to support himself being, you know, as rich as he is, and he doesn't need anybody else's help or backing. And so he can just sort of go and say things and tell people off and just shoot from the hip and not give a crap. And that's what people on the alt-right really liked about him. And although I was always much more skeptical than the typical alt-righter, I still enjoyed the whole phenomenon. I liked him, seeing him, you know, make the Republican establishment angry and upset, and then the Democratic establishment angry and upset, and all the whole establishment, you know, just railing and rallying against him. But the more they attacked him, the stronger he became. That whole sort of thing. I mean, it was very entertaining to watch, and it seemed like somewhere along the way, part of the strategy against Trump was that some people in elite circles noticed this alt-right phenomenon, and somebody put it in Hillary Clinton's ear apparently sometime. Well, maybe you should tie Trump to the alt-right, and you know this, and she probably said, "Who's the alt-right?" And then they told her something or other, or they, whoever wrote the speech for her, you know, had her say these lines. And so suddenly the alt-right was out there. It was something that a major presidential candidate was talking about, was mentioning. And then suddenly all of the major mainstream media outlets were all saying, alt-right, alt-right, what's the alt-right? What's the alt-right? And, you know, ooh, they're scary, but they're interesting. But they're scary, they're gross, but they're interesting. You know, they sort of, you know, they hate us, but they also can't stop talking about us. So on some level, they, you know, like us, or they enjoy having us around in one way or another. So that's how we, if I may use the word we to describe myself as a part of the alt-right. Again, I have, you know, when people talk about what is alt-right and what isn't, you know, there's some people who say you have to be this particular kind of person, and you have to believe these particular things, you know, and if you don't believe these things, then you're not really a true alt-righter. And, you know, they, of course, have this disparaging term, alt-light. I don't think I fit perfectly. I don't think I've ever fit perfectly into the mold of what the typical alt, what might be called the typical alt-righter might be. But it is the movement around which I, you know, started to get some attention with my writings and later with my blog and some interviews that I was doing and with the books that I was writing and so forth. And so, anyway, to cut a long story short, I think that the alt-right became a thing because we were the heavies. We were the bad guys. We were like the new Nazis and the new Ku Klux Klan. And of course, that's silly and you know, and ridiculous, I think. But it was this what they thought, what Trump's opponents thought was a useful thing, a useful sort of rhetorical trick that they put in their arsenal to try to say, hey, look at these people who like Trump. Look at how scary they are. So Trump must be one of them. And I don't think that Trump ever really knew what the alt-right was either. But I think he must have been aware on some level that he was, you know, he had to walk this tightrope between, you know, not totally going out there to an extreme where even he couldn't get away with it. And I was amazed. I have been amazed by the kind of things that he has gotten away with. I mean, just as a side note, going back a ways, when he talked about John McCain and how, and I don't like John McCain at all, don't get me wrong, but it seemed like a very, very insulting thing to say. And where he said, well, he got captured. You know, I like a soldier who doesn't get captured. I mean, I don't understand why that didn't finish Trump when he said that, but it didn't, you know, and I was amazed. And there were many things after that that he just recovered from. And
yeah, if you examine McCain's record, there are things that, you know, that they covered up that, you know, was where he shot ordnance off. He was goof cowboying on the plane, on the aircraft carrier. Fried seamen. He's in the Navy, right?
I think so. I mean, I'm not defending him.
Yeah.
But it just seemed like that statement was something that I was like, oh my God, you know, and you know, POWs everywhere, I thought, would be angry with.
Yeah. Well,
with
Trump. Some POWs don't like McCain.
Yeah. Well, as yeah. Okay. I mean, and it turned out maybe he was, you know, smarter and shrewder than anybody expected.
Maybe 10 years before that remark would have gotten in more trouble. Whereas by 2016, people are a little, the whole patriotic, you know, veteran thing is a little shop worn for many people.
Well, it is shop worn, but it's still, they still trot it out there.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Every year, every Super Bowl, every.
Well, same like the racist charge, right? They try to use that against Trump. And
yeah. No, that's the interesting thing. And I was getting a little long winded there talking about the alt-right and how the alt-right came to a kind of prominence in 2016. But I think that that's the really interesting thing with regard to Trump. I mean, the alt-right would never have gotten the notice that it did if the Democrats hadn't decided to start talking about the alt-right and start trying to talk about the alt-right as this evil white supremacist neo-Nazi movement, which again is completely unfair and does not do justice to what the alt-right, you know, the full spectrum of ideas and philosophies that make up the alt-right. There's a quite a bit of diversity among thinkers who are alt-right thinkers. And some of them aren't focused on race really much at all.
Yeah, he also talked about America First, which caught the ire of the ADL for some reason.
But another very potent term that, you know, people obviously and some could and some did connect it with the 40s isolationism, Charles Lindbergh and that whole gang, which were thought to be.
It represented a counterforce to the eastern seaboard elite, whereas the sort of Midwestern industrial interests that had its own interests, its own culture away from the two, you know, the two coasts. And I don't know if Trump knew that he was telegraphing that or signaling that, but he did.
That's the thing about him. You don't know. I mean, he sounds like he sounds like he just blunders into things, or just, you know, the same kind of haphazard way that he has of talking. He's not somebody who strikes you as especially articulate or thoughtful, but yet he pushes these buttons without, and then, you know, we think it's going to just, that's going to be the end of him. And yet he somehow gets through it. And, you know, even the grab him by the, you know what, recording that surfaced. I mean, that didn't kill him either. I mean, he rebounded from even something as damning as that. So anyway, I think the interesting thing about the alt-right with respect to Trump is that he still managed to win while being constantly tarred and feathered, you know, metaphorically speaking, as a racist, you know, and as somebody who sympathizes with the racist, as somebody who won't disavow racists, you know, racist, 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 Nazi, Nazi, Nazi. That's all the media ever said, pretty much. And yet he still got elected. And I think that's the really interesting thing. It's not so much that the alt-right came to prominence, because that, I think the alt-right coming to a certain kind of prominence was almost fluky, just in the sense that we have Hillary Clinton and the Democrats and the liberals to thank for that, because they decided to put us out there as the bogeymen and to try to tie Trump to us and to make Trump contemptible in the eyes of, you know, the populace by saying that he was one of us.
He was the deplorables.
Yes, he was one of us deplorables, and that didn't work.
And also
that's the really interesting thing.
The irony of the Clintons trying to pull out sexual scandals too.
Yeah. I mean. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, maybe we'll come around to talking about the reptilians in a minute, but I mean, they are completely shameless they're just the norm though. I mean, maybe that's the thing. I mean, I hold them in particular contempt, Bill and Hillary Clinton, but then again, I think sometimes, well, maybe they're just sort of, a particularly egregious example of the norm, the norm is. And, you know, I don't have strong feelings about Obama personally. I've never felt, you know, icky about, or felt that he is icky personally. I haven't liked him, but he might be just as bad as the Clintons are. And he might just be, I don't know, for some reason doesn't flip the same switch in me that Bill and Hillary do.
Yeah, well, if he's spending $60,000 or flying in pizza from Chicago,
pizza, quote unquote, and hot dogs, quote unquote.
Yeah, from Chicago, and using the same channels, but that's maybe for.
Yeah, and waitresses, literally, quote unquote.
So, now my take on Trump was when he first ran. And it appeared he was going to get the nomination as the summer approached. I thought he was being put in there as a pretty much to assure Hillary's election. But by late September, October, I noticed that there was a turning. One thing was the exposure of her health problems, and then the WikiLeaks were exposed all the various scandals of the Clinton Foundation. Hillary Clinton and these things, and it appeared that
some factions, some element within the deep state had turned against the Clintons, and which isn't too surprising because if you have a career like the Clintons, you probably make a lot of enemies.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of lives ruined, a lot of dead bodies. So that's you know, that's sort of a karma coming back to haunt them, I guess. But there's something more to it than that. And it seemed as though maybe Trump, although he comes across as has his own man, he's a billionaire, and he wouldn't be allowed to have gone as far as he did if some factions within the elite wanted him to be there.
Right.
So maybe his
and he was pals with the Clintons.
Yes.
Not that long ago. He was.
Yeah, he was at the wedding and all.
And going golfing with and in 2008 he talked about they were they were great people people who didn't like Bill Clinton's presidency were just jealous of him. I mean, he was actually saying things like that just 8 years ago, and now he's talking about how they're criminals. I mean, I was happy to hear him say the things he said, and I thought it was great, you know, getting all of Bill Clinton's alleged victims to invite them to the debate. I thought that was totally righteous.
But if you study if you just look at the below the surface of Trump, and you know, he didn't come out of nowhere. Obviously, he inherited millions.
Oh gosh, you know, like there's an interview with him back in like the 70s, like the late 70s, where he's he's really just baby faced and just emerging. And the interviewer asks him, "Would you ever want to run for president?" And it's like, and you can find this on YouTube. After we talk, I'll send you the link. I can't remember who the interviewer is right now, but it's just sort of like a short 2-minute segment. And you kind of think to yourself, why is she asking him that? Why is she asking this real estate guy who's just getting started, you know?
I mean, 30-something.
Yeah, in his 30s.
Yeah.
Why is she asking him if he'd ever run for president? And he sort of gives an equivocal answer. He's very careful, very, you know, parsed language about it. And it's fascinating to watch. He's always sort of seems like he's always kind of been biding his time and noticing what's going on. It's careful not to alienate anybody. If you can believe that Trump in the 80s and so forth, when he's asked about politics, he doesn't really say very much.
No, everyone's a great guy. They're all qualified. There was Dukakis,
terrific
Bush,
guy.
Terrific guy, they're all qualified, really competent, I like him, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But if you look at Trump's background, obviously comes from the casino world.
Right.
That's Resorts International, which traces back to Mario Lansky. It's the Mario Kart paint company. And it's organized crime, drugs, these things. But that's how integrated these things are into our economy. He's also, he studied under Roy Cohn. Mob lawyer, worked with McCarthy. This shows how integrated organized crime is with the political world. But one analysis which I found particularly interesting was he comes from the sort of the organized crime faction of the elite. You talk about the families, the five families, people that run the casinos, the hotels, hospitality industry, the tourist industry, casinos, and these things. And it took a big hit with Obamacare because that took a huge chunk out of people's disposable income. And also these people tend to be particularly patriotic. Maybe they're not be globalists, although they're kind of like a local elite, local criminal elite. Local criminal elite care about their neighborhoods, care about where they live.
Yeah.
They're not international, not transnationalists.
Right.
And so this might represent a pushback or a struggle within that faction, which is –
That's interesting.
You know, so he was put in there to signaling there's maybe some desire among the elite, or at least a significant faction of the elite, for some retrenchment, some overturned or, say, equity capitalism as opposed to transnational finance capitalism.
Right.
Which means there might be a time for reinvestment in the reindustrialization of the economy, these things. I look at that because I'm trying to put an optimistic interpretation on the election, as opposed to saying it's all fixed, it's all rigged, it doesn't matter, blah blah blah. You know, I'm saying, yeah, the elites do control the elections because they decide who we get to choose from, right? The two people we vote for. I'm saying sometimes you can divine from the candidates we're allowed to vote for some sort of what changes they're making, and there could be a faction within the elite look at the situation. You know, Hillary Clinton bear baiting provoking the Russians, all this interventionism yeah. abroad, that maybe it had gone too far. It's time to slow down a little bit and reverse policy,
right.
retrench a little bit. And
right. so not to be globalism on steroids.
Yeah.
anymore for the time being.
So I mean that's one way to look at it. So that's probably I think a cautiously optimistic way to look at it. Because mm-hmm. I don't think we should put too much stock in elections and voting and these things.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, I think they are controlled.
Yes.
But nevertheless, the Trump presidency, it was something that no one would have predicted a year ago, or at least
no.
maybe 18 months ago.
Absolutely not.
And it happened.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, this leads us now to sort of the reaction to it, which is this one thing is this hysteria regarding Russian hijacking the elections. And apparently Russia, the CIA, leaking its classified report that found that there a consensus that there was Russian influence in the elections. I don't know what that means, but I guess mm-hmm. it's being interpreted as somehow the Putin was able to install his boy Trump in the White House, and now Russia's about to take over the United States because of this.
Yeah, that's so silly.
And then you have this ridiculous situation where you have Mitch McConnell and various senators talking, we need to investigate this, and we shouldn't tolerate our cyber attacks on our elections. Which
it's amazing. It's like yeah. It's like some people want to stoke a new Cold War, and it's the very reverse of the people who were into the Cold War before, the people saying don't trust the Russians and mm-hmm. They're a bunch of commies and stuff. That was what the conservative Republicans were all about. And
although it did start as a Democratic project with Harry Truman.
So. Okay, well that's true. There is that faction as well.
There were different factions within that Cold
right.
War. There was a left wing faction of the internationalists.
Yeah, and the neocons were Democrats.
At first. The Trotskyites mm-hmm. and these things.
Right.
And you had the Alger Hiss, wing, and you had yeah. The Alger Hiss communist wing, and the Dulles pro-Nazi wing of the Cold War of the interventionist.
Uh-huh.
To oversimplify, but that's kind of like two different wings of this interventionist state, and it was kind of like a battle right. between the two camps in the Truman mm-hmm. administration and the Eisenhower administration. I guess you could say. The Dulles wing was ascendant with the election of Eisenhower,
mm-hmm.
And the imprisonment of Alger Hiss.
And is this the faction that the guy who, I don't know if you've talked to him. Who's the guy who says that there's a fascist, secret fascist group that could really controls the world?
Oh, that's Dr. Joseph Farrell. Yeah.
Yes. Right.
That wouldn't say it controls the world, but it is one important faction of this post-war arrangement.
Right. They've sort of gone deep underground.
Yeah, they're very powerful, and it's an important, it's an interesting theory. You have to reconcile with other things like the mm-hmm. The power of the Zionist. And the more you look at it, these from time to time, the Nazis work well with the Zionists.
Yeah, they were Zionists, weren't they?
So it's one of these things where it's easy.
Madagascar.
A lot of the people who saw the interview, the comments are like, it's all Nazis running the world. And of course, they claim it's the Jews running the world. Well, nah, it's not either or. It's not
right.
These are various factions. Right. But he talks about the Nazi International, this idea at the end of World War II or near the end of World War II. I guess it was particularly after the defeat at Stalingrad, Martin Bormann. Got together with the German businessmen, and they were fully integrated into the Western, IBM and Ford and GM and these things, IT&T and all that. So it involves a lot of these transnational or multinational corporate relationships. Standard Oil, right, making sure that mm-hmm. the Luftwaffe got its tetraethyl to fly its air during the war.
Sure.
You don't want to let a war get in the way of business, right?
Right.
So it gets very the waters get very murky when you get into these things. It's not this simple, Nazi Germany versus Great Britain or America
sure.
versus Germany. It's at that meta level, it's all so murky.
Yeah.
But what happened was the Nazis determined that the Nazi state was not going to exist as a state. but it would have to go on sort of as a multinational, transnational state. And so they set up arrangements, business arrangements, where they pretty much got all the stocks and all the patents and all the stuff and internationalized it. And then near the end of the war, this was part of the negotiations between the SS and Dulles and Bern, Switzerland, that he arranged, this is where the rat line comes in and the Operation Paperclip.
Right. And, yes.
And they
taking all
up.
The Nazis to America to work on the rocket or the space program.
Yeah, the Galen Network, which formed the Soviet desk of the CIA. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, you wonder why we had a Cold War, Nazis,
Right.
And this also with the loot that the Nazis had acquired during the war. So that, funded the what they call the Black Eagle Trust, which is a sort of a huge slush fund that the intelligence agencies use for black ops. And somehow or another, he works. I mean, you want to get off track, but he factors into 9/11 and these things. This is
I had been listening to a couple of his interviews lately. I wasn't sure what to make of all of that, but it was interesting. Yeah,
to order to appreciate it, you have to read a lot of his material, and it's not quite. A lot of people look at this thing as saying, "Well, no, that's ridiculous."
A lot of people are just dismissive. I mean,
they're dismissive because they don't want their own, they're set on their own idea of what happened.
Right.
And he offers
which kind of reminds me of Pizzagate too. Not to get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. But he offers a different layer to the 9/11 onion, I guess you could say, how you should look at these things, because his theory doesn't contradict other people's theories; it adds to it.
Yeah.
Another layer. That's
right.
So.
Right.
But
it's very intricate.
Yeah. If you look at things like Paperclip and the CIA and Galen and the work, the fact that the Israelis worked with the Nazis after the war, and I think who was it that Otto Skorzeny worked with the Israelis after
really?
The war.
Really?
And
I didn't know that.
It's hard to really take these dichotomy or these these divisions seriously. Like, is it really Nazis versus the Jews?
Like on the highest level, maybe all the power mongers are in league.
Yeah, and among the elite Zionists, the Jews are fodder.
Yeah.
The same way that among the elite Anglo-American, of course, I think roughly speaking, the Anglo-American Zionists are kind of like on one side.
The same way that the Jewish elites in Hollywood might victimize two young Jewish boys like Corey Haim and Corey Feldman.
Yeah. Or they might perpetrate or foment revolution in Russia or a war with Russia.
Right. Despite
all the suffering that millions of Jews would go through because of that. Because it fulfills their ideological vision.
Yeah. Well, in my book, which we talked about earlier this year, I mentioned the reptilian our reptilian rulers. I try to explain that I'm not talking about literal reptilians.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to explain that I'm not just saying this isn't just code language for Jews either, Jews are represented among this group, but there are others represented among this group as well, and there are Jews who are not among this group.
Yeah.
There's
the of course the Anglo. Elite, who it's hard to say which is the junior partner or which is the senior partner in this relationship. It probably goes back and forth, but nevertheless, they're both involved in some pretty, ruthless, intrigues to maintain their empires.
And they both hate Catholics.
Yeah. that's the British policy.
And we're two Catholic guys talking here, so.
Yeah, that was the British policy against the Habsburg throne.
Yeah.
Which... part of the reason why you got the First World War. It's also one of the reasons why you had some people think why you had so much British influence during the French Revolution was to unseat another Catholic monarch. Back to what we're talking about as far as Trump goes in, this different faction, at some point it was determined, I think, that Hillary Clinton was simply too corrupt and perhaps too ill to be a useful puppet. And Trump was allowed to win.
and he won.
Yeah, I'm sure there's stuff going. I don't know what it is, and we probably never will know. But I'm sure there's stuff going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. That I mean, you say you wanted to put as positive a spin on things as possible, but I mean, I find myself thinking if Trump, if the deep state didn't want Trump to win, Trump wouldn't have won. I mean, that's
my point. Yeah,
I don't want to say that like, there's no point in doing anything. You know, it's all controlled and we can't do anything about it. I'm not counseling passivity.
I think the deep state, the elites, the oligarchs have to at some point consider public opinion.
Right.
And so my point is that's just the point. Trump the phenomenon versus Trump the man.
Yeah.
Meaning that they have so. It's not pointless. I mean, you can say electoral politics, democracy is all window dressing, but window dressing serves a function.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's not.
And you're drawing the distinction between Trump the phenomenon and Trump the man. I've heard people talk about on the alt-right who are maybe starting to, maybe the disillusionment is starting to set in mm-hmm. as they see most of his cabinet being just. Same old kind of, entrenched establishment people.
Yeah, all these generals.
Right.
You have this guy Mnuchin, who's a Goldman Sachs guy, who's
one of these
vulture capitalists.
Yeah.
He's a more or less a one of these corporate welfare queens. You have a cabinet full of billionaires.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to look at it and say, oh boy, how can you drain the swamp? The only problem with draining the swamp is if you drain the swamp, there's nothing left there. That's that bad. That's where we are as far as, we just have to wait and see, what happens after January 20th.
It's just like they were sort of talking when I've heard alt-right people talk, about this. They talk about Trump the meme, as opposed to Trump the man. That's the distinction I heard them drawing, which I thought was interesting. And because they had a lot of fun, with memeing Trump, it's just hilarious how Pepe the Frog has become this. Oh, what does this mean? It's a symbol of hate, this Pepe the Frog, and it's just like this cartoon frog. I mean, it's so bizarre. It gets weirder when you find out that, like in Illuminati circles, the frog god is something or other. Do you know about this?
Yeah, I've heard. Yeah.
So was it prophetic? I don't know. I don't know if I believe that or not, but it's weird.
Yeah. But I mean, he said things like he called out the F-35 program. This boondoggle, this plane that can't fly at night or something or during fog. And of course, I personally think some of these programs are just huge embezzlement schemes. They're just
right.
This is why the Pentagon can't track trillions of dollars and these things. It goes into the black budget.
Yeah,
funds all types of. Other things, perhaps, I don't know, underground cities, I don't know, but
the trillion, however many trillion dollars that disappeared from the Pentagon, a budget,
I'm sure it just disappeared.
Yes.
more of the financial chicanery, it's all around 9/11, but he said that, and he's talked about stop, he's actually said we have to stop overturning governments abroad, which is kind of funny, because we entered into this discussion, we're talking about this idea of Russian hijacking the elections. You have all these politicians in high dudgeon over the notion that a foreign government would ever seek influence in a U.S. election.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't see. Well, you remember all the problems with Bill Clinton and China, campaign fundraising, all that, or not to mention this. The how many coups have been orchestrated by the CIA since 1947?
Yeah.
We
can influence their elections, but they can't influence our elections.
Do the names Mossadegh and Arbenz ring any bells? I mean, how many times have the Marines
Pinochet?
Pinochet, or how many times have the Marines gone into like Nicaragua or Cuba to secure the assets of National City Bank or Chase Manhattan Bank and these things? And not to mention what was done in Europe, funded by narcotics trafficking. using the mob to suppress, you know, the elections in Italy in the late 40s. Not to mention all the terrorism that's occurred. Like in Gladio, Gladio was a terrorist operation
right.
conducted by CIA, Western intelligence agencies, fascist groups, this P2 Lodge, Masonic Lodge, to affect elections.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
so,
absolutely.
I mean, I don't know. It's lists around. Like Jay did a show. Jay Jai did a show post today, and he just had an endless list of coups and elections and what's going on in Ukraine right now. What's going on in Syria right now? We're trying to topple
yeah.
legitimate government to the extent that any
yeah.
government's legitimate. I mean,
right
you know,
to whatever extent
yeah.
you know, any government is any state is legitimate, quote
yeah.
unquote.
I mean, there's and that's just openly discussed. How I think Barack Obama just signed an executive order. Allowing for the shipment of funds for
yeah.
For rebel groups
in Syria.
Syria,
right?
Well, what's that? You know, what was Fast and Furious? It was
yeah.
a destabilization in Latin America, and you know, if we want to talk about immigration, the destabilization of North Africa, Libya, and Syria has been used to create this huge migration into Europe, which is so destabilizing,
right?
You know, that's not destabilizing, you know, governments of Europe and the U.S. and NATO are behind that. So,
yeah, they created the conditions that brought it about.
Yeah. And even the immigration issue in the United States has been aggravated by U.S. policy in Latin America over the past century.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure. I mean, yeah. And people, the people who come, I mean, I think I made this point last time. We talked that you know, with immigration. I mean, I'm against illegal immigration. I'm for protecting the borders and all that. But I think that you know, people who come here or people who pack themselves into these little boats and try to make it to I don't know, the coast of Italy or whatever. I mean, you don't do something like that unless you're desperate. And that's not me saying that you know. That I'm in favor of open borders and globalism and so forth. But I do think that we have to keep in mind that these people are just pawns, more or less.
And, yes.
And they aren't the true enemy. They aren't, I mean, they shouldn't be here. And I'm in favor of deporting them if they're here illegally. But the ones the true enemies are the ones who have created the condition, the ones with the power who have created these kinds of conditions to, you know, use these people as pawns and use we in the West, you know, who just have normal lives, who aren't part of the elite as pawns. And I think that that's something I've tried to emphasize, you know, and that maybe makes me a little bit looked at somewhat suspiciously by some on the alt-right, because, you know, it seems like I'm not pro-white, quote-unquote, enough. But I do think that, you know, the real bad guys are the ones in power, the ones who, you know, have this, who are orchestrating all these things, manipulating all of these events and making all these things happen, you know, and are just terrible, awful, you know, seemingly soulless people.
Well, yeah, because they're the ones that are, you know, bombing Syria, or
yeah,
they're the ones that, you know, destroyed Libya, and for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, to prevent the pipeline, to secure a pipeline.
Yeah, there's some pretext. There's always a pretext. But,
yeah.
I you mentioned drug trafficking and how that's the, you know, a very lucrative way that. Supposedly legitimate governments, you know, get a lot of dough, and you know, they take part in things like that. And I guess to try to make things topical, I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about, you know, human trafficking, sex trafficking, even child sex trafficking. I mean, it gets more and more disgusting and appalling, and so forth. But you know,
there's yeah, both drugs and human trafficking, and particularly, you know, when you talk about traffic, usually you're talking about the prostitution, they thrive in areas of destabilization.
Sure.
And so there are powers that I think want to create areas of destabilization, both home and abroad, to create more lucrative markets, make more money,
yeah.
provide. And you could see that both in terms of child trafficking and drug trafficking.
And it's got to be, you know, it's of course illegal, and of course, you know, one of the worst possible crimes that one can imagine, but it's also got to have, you've got to imagine there's a market for it, you know, with regard to everything that part of the things that were discovered through WikiLeaks, some of the things that have, you know, interested me, I don't know if that's the right word, but have riveted my attention has been the connections of the establishment to these kinds of, you know, really, I mean, it just gets worse and worse the more you look into it. I don't know if I even, like the last time we talked, I mean, I knew about the Franklin scandal in the 80s, and we talked, I think we made reference to that with regard to talking about my book, Conspiracy, Compliance, Control, and Defiance. Shameless plug there. but I don't think I'd wrap my head around things like that governments like the United States and others are in all probability complicit in, you know, in selling, in kidnapping kids and you know, selling them to perverted people who have a lot of money to do what they want with them. I mean, and just things like what was discovered through WikiLeaks, and this, it was a sort of a slow but steady unraveling that happened like in October and November. I was following, and I'm not so obsessive that I was poring over all of these emails myself, you know, with a magnifying glass looking for things. I was relying on, you know, secondhand accounts of what other people were finding. But when it came out that Laura Silsby, this woman, and I remembered her story, you know, after there was the big earthquake in Haiti in 2010, I remembered hearing about this woman who claimed to be a Christian missionary and who tried to abscond from Haiti, you know, which was in a terrible state at the time because of the earthquake. It's already, you know, an impoverished country. But she and a few other people tried to take 33 kids, I think, out of Haiti. The claim was that she was going to take them to an orphanage. The claim was that they were orphans and she was going to take them to an orphanage in the Dominican Republic, but it was all very sketchy. There was no orphanage being planned, as it turned out. And the whole organization looked like it was a sham. And so the Haitian authorities, you know, rightly, threw them in jail and charged them with kidnapping. And of course the Clintons with their, their foundation, they, as it turns out, we see through WikiLeaks that they were involved with this woman, Laura Silsby, and they were following this whole story. And then Bill Clinton actually flew down to Haiti to Springer and all these other so-called missionaries out of jail. And she was found guilty, but was given a suspended sentence. And so there's a, you know, that unraveled, and that was sort of like, wow, you know, I knew before that these people were, you know, ruthless and that there was no, and unscrupulous, and that there was absolutely no bottom to the evil depravities to which they were capable. But somehow I hadn't quite grappled with this idea that they were, you know, profiting off of selling kids to who knows who for who knows what, and that in this case they were, you know, this woman was stopped, and I forgot to say that the kids that she tried to leave with, she said they were orphans. It turned out they weren't really orphans, that they had parents who were still alive, but who they just talked into, I don't know, somehow, you know, talked the parents into taking them away somehow or other. So that was a big thing. And then, of course, the connection, which I knew at the time, but it seems like it's come into even greater focus and greater scrutiny since then, the connection that the Clintons had to Jeffrey Epstein, who was convicted sex, convicted, what is he convicted of exactly? Pedophilia or?
He was convicted of solicitation of sex of a minor.
Right.
He had, I think, close to 40 accusers. He ended up serving 12 months of an 18-month sentence.
Yeah, he got a slap on the wrist, and all the elites of both parties, and I was impressed when Ann Coulter actually talked about this and said, no, it's not just a Democrat thing. It's Ken Starr, you know, the big shot. What's the name of his title again? The title that he had.
Well, he was a special prosecutor.
Special prosecutor. The
or
guy who supposedly prosecuted.
Prosecutor, whatever, yeah.
But there's a guy who was supposedly the enemy of the Clintons, and now he's going to bat with these people, you know, who are mostly Democrats.
And his that's funny because his pedigree is interesting. He is the great nephew of Cornelis van der Staar, who found CV Star Insurance Company, which would become AIG.
Really?
And he also was the one who worked on the memo that William French Smith, the Attorney General for the early Reagan administration, it was the memo that allowed the CIA gave case officers the green light not to report drug dealing in Central America. This was the run up to the Iran-Contra thing. Scandal when they started, selling cocaine to pay for arms. The Contras were selling cocaine to pay for the arms to get around the Democratic Congress that cut off funding.
Yeah.
So
he was the one who said with the Vince Foster death, which is there's so much sketchy about that, and he just sort of said, "Nope, nothing to see here, just a suicide."
Vince Foster, there's a whiff of pedophilia in the Vince Foster case.
Really? I didn't know that.
I interviewed Dean Arnold. He wrote a book about Vince Foster death. And in all, there is a child trafficking. There is a cover to a report in all the files regarding child trafficking, which makes one think, what was Vince Foster uncovering or involved in that led to his death?
Yeah.
Was it the cocaine in Mena, Arkansas, which ties back to Iran-Contra, which ties into the Bushes, and goes back to, goes back to Ken Starr and William French Smith back in 82 when they signed that memo. All these things are connected. Which makes you reevaluate the whole Clinton-Lewinsky thing. Was it a diversion?
Yeah, well, that was something that he was willing to, just throw himself behind totally I still think it was, evidence that of what a scumbag Bill Clinton was. But
no doubt about that.
But it wasn't anything like the Vince Foster case, which was much more serious.
Yeah, which would open up a whole can of worms and much more threatening to the establishment.
Yeah.
The establishment than a philandering president.
And that brings us to Pizzagate, and I just wanted, I sort of started to go into it with what I was saying about the what was being revealed in the WikiLeaks that the Clintons had connections with Laura Silsby and apparent child trafficking in Haiti, and then the connection with Jeffrey Epstein. I don't think there was much about that in the WikiLeaks files, but then I think the thing that's been capturing most people's interest because of its luridity is the Podesta email, the numerous Podesta emails. First of all, what seems to be clear that the Podestas are sickos. I mean, at least as far as judging from the art that they have up in their homes and in their office, especially Tony Podesta in his home, but John also in his office has a picture of two men eating another man, and weird stuff. And so then all these references to pizza, which were, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on this because it's been talked about to death, but, and I'm sure everybody listening to this pretty much already knows, doesn't really need a primer on any of this stuff, but.
Yeah, they're emails that are obviously using code words, because if you read them literally, they make no sense. But if you punch in the code words, it appears to suggest a pedophile operation.
Or activity that, you know, with pedophilic activity.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the code corresponds to code language that's been used on the deep web. I just know this secondhand, not firsthand. But.
Yeah, and recognized by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Apparently, their agents are told to look for these words when investigating pedophilia.
Yeah.
So.
And pizza will never be the same again. I mean, I've got to say.
Thing is all these elite people who are so infatuated with hot dogs and pizza.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd think they would have fancier food than that. Yeah, exactly. And so. All of that unfolded, and then of course the ties were found to the Comet Pizza ping pong, where, to be fair, there hasn't been any hard evidence that any children have been harmed at this particular location, I think if you stake too much on the question of whether Comet Pizza Ping Pong is a front for a child's sex trafficking ring, I think that's going to be, in that sense, Pizzagate could be a trap for you if that's what, you know, if that's what you're, if you're putting all your eggs in that basket. I don't know if that's, you know, I don't think there's hard evidence of that. All the evidence that we have is circumstantial, and it's really not circumstantial evidence about, that indicates that there's necessarily any illegal activity, but there's just a lot of really gross, awful, inappropriate innuendo, like what was found on the Comet Instagram page, the numerous pictures there of children and people making these sly little references to, you know, to sex, and, you know, the seeming sexualization of everything and relating sex to pizza and pornographic images involving children and, you know, and all these kinds of things, which are awful. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be seen as terrible, but I do think that, you know, I've had people say I've heard people talk about how we shouldn't spend too much time looking at Pizzagate, and, you know, it's a trap, and they're gonna use it, you know, with this whole fake news crusade. They're gonna say, look, people are getting hurt because of fake news and blah blah blah. But I do think that we have to see Pizzagate more broadly, and Pizzagate doesn't just involve Comet Pizza Ping Pong. It involves the Podestas. It involves even possibly the Madeleine McCann kidnapping, which I would have just dismissed that as crazy. And it's still, I still find it really strange, but apparently, you know, some say that there are connections that the Podesta brothers were there. There are some reports that they were in the proximity when that took place. And of course what do they call it? The crime sketch, the criminal sketches that were made, which closely resemble them.
Yeah, it's hard to pin down when those appeared, and what's the provenance of those sketches. It's weird. It's almost as if they're being put out there. And you heard the story about the McCanns having lunch with Sigmund Freud's.
Yes.
Was it a great grandson?
Something like that. Yeah. Who was later found to have molested girls, underage girls.
and shared an office with Sarah Smith, and now the posthumously exposed pedophile, a member of parliament.
Yeah, or Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, so their kid goes missing, never to be found. Then they're having lunch with this guy, Clement Freud, the grandson of Sigmund Freud, he's a pedophile, and
yeah,
I think the wife is quoted as the mother is quoted as saying that he kept us smiling when it was difficult to smile. Something to that effect.
Why would you want to smile after your kid just got kidnapped?
I mean, you shouldn't be smiling.
You wouldn't want to smile.
Yeah. So
you want to find your kid.
Yeah. So. I don't know. You're right.
Yeah.
It gets weird.
It spirals out in many directions, and some of them are more, I don't know, incredible seeming. I'm not saying they're not true. But some of them, there seems to be a lot of evidence for. I mean, if we include the ties of the Clintons to Haiti, and with Laura Silsby, and also the recent death of what's her name, Monica Peterson, this young woman who was investigating child trafficking, and you know, saw the Clintons as being involved, and went to Haiti to find some things out, and then turned up dead, You know, I think if we include all of these things in the broad spectrum or gestalt, let's say, of Pizzagate, then Pizzagate is not what the people who are lampooning it right now are trying to present it as. It's really interesting how mainstream sources, you know, people on like Steve Colbert, who I used to like. Now I can't stand him. And Saturday Night Live, they have these people coming mocking the whole Pizzagate thing. And you know, it's fascinating that they are feeling the need to do this. I mean,
yeah.
Don't you think that? I mean, in the 80s and early 90s, when the Franklin scandal was breaking, it never got that far. I mean,
and Franklin scandal had a state legislative investigation.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it never broke out in the way that, in the sense that they did, the mainstream sources didn't say, we're going to have to address this. And when we're going to have to mock this, we're going to have to get some late night, figure to do a routine about this, to mock these crazy people who are into this. I mean, it never got to that point.
And at the same time, they don't address the circumstantial evidence, which would seem to justify the suspicion that people are having. You know,
it's just fake news, nothing to see here, fake news. I mean, but...
Did you read the New York Times piece? I just saw it yesterday about Mike Pence being... invited to go to Comet Ping Pong for lunch.
Oh no, I haven't heard that.
And
no.
it's in your. I'm reading this article, and it's like the New York Times uses that Comet Ping Pong pizza was the subject of a fake news story in the run up to the election. That's how they cover it. That's it.
Yeah. Well, they had an article earlier about it where they were just saying, where the headline was, "No, this is not this pizzeria. This DC pizzeria is not a child trafficking site." And then the article itself was just. Again, it didn't. If you're going to debunk something, you know, tell why it isn't true. I mean, I would respect that if it was like really grappling with the evidence or grappling with what's out there and saying, but really, here's why it's all hooey.
Explain the artwork in that place.
Yeah.
You know, explain the Instagrams. Explain the one email that had. Three children being delivered to a pool party out in Lovettsville, Virginia, and their ages are given, and they're described as entertainment for the party.
Somebody should be talking. I mean,
no one's challenged the provenance of those emails. No one's saying this is a fake email.
To my mind, nobody has really, nobody has said, "Oh, all you crazy people who think that pizza means child sex, it doesn't. Here's what it really means." I don't think there's been no. no effort to counter, you know, that I know of, that whole, I mean, and you would think that, again, if they were normal people and not reptilians, if you know, if you or I were being, if our email was hacked and somebody found what they thought was code language referring to pedophilia, and they were just talking all these places, it was all over the place on the internet, you know, oh, well, such and such is a pedophile. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I would get out there pretty quickly and say, you know, this is absolutely untrue. This is slander. Here's what it really meant. When you know, I don't like the fact that my emails were read, but now that it's all out there, here's what it really meant. And I take this very seriously. And, you know, I'm, you better stop saying that I'm a pedophile or I'm going to sue somebody. I mean, that's what I would do.
Yeah, yeah. The whole, remember the whole, in 2011, a year before he died, Breitbart accusing Podesta of engaging in child trafficking.
Yeah, something like that. On Twitter.
Yeah, on Twitter. And he's on videotape at it looks like he's at like it's CPAC or something.
Yeah.
And he makes that accusation on film, on video. And there's no lawsuit. I mean, if that were true, you would think, you know, he's supposedly right-wing, Breitbart, right-wing conservative platform news site. You could, you know, with resources, they'd shut it down. But no, but then again, Breitbart doesn't talk about it again. He kind of leaves it out there. And then he dies at age 43 of a heart attack or something.
When he's in perfect health and so forth.
Another unexpected death, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Among many.
You know.
So but that's really strange to me that nobody has tried to explain. I mean, none of the principals have tried to explain. The Podesta brothers have not said anything about it. Nobody else close to the scene, nobody of the people that they wrote to who also wrote back these cryptic, seemingly, you know, this code laden stuff where they're talking about consuming cheese or pasta or playing dominoes on pasta or cheese and, you know, pizza related map and all this kind of stuff. Nobody has, you'd think that somebody would want to clear their name.
Yeah.
But they're all keeping silent, which, you know, suggests to me they've got something to hide. Just because, you know, if it were me, I would certainly not be keeping silent if these kind of things were being bandied about me.
No, and I think just recently Podesta started using his Twitter, and he didn't address that issue. And he was talking about recounts or electoral college or something. I don't know what the subject of the Twitter was about.
Right. I mean, and it's just, it's just this disconnect. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying before in our last interview, and that's what kind of intrigued me, but also just, you know, it gets very, very dark if you look at it too much time around it.
As far as the mainstream news outlets dropping the ball on this, that's not too surprising, given what they did with the Franklin scandal and some other things.
And the Franklin scandal mostly, and I mean, you know, we talk about liberal bias and whatever, but the Franklin scandal almost, and people listening who haven't heard of the Franklin scandal should Google it, but it's something similar to Pizzagate, except that in that case there were actual accusers. I mean, there was more credible evidence, and of course it never went anywhere, really. And many of the accusers died under mysterious circumstances, and there's all kinds of really dark and upsetting ramifications to it all. But that involved mostly Republicans, and there too, I mean, there are, I was thinking about it the other day, and it does seem that there are parallels that can be drawn between the Franklin scandal and Pizzagate. One of them being Larry King, not the broadcaster Larry King, but the Republican, the prominent figure in the Republican Party at the time, in the 80s, black Republican, who had all of, you know, who was running a federal savings and loan in Nebraska, in Omaha, Nebraska. And, he, for some reason, you know, everyone was deferential to him, and he had all this power. And why did he have all this power? Nobody really knew, but he must. We know that blackmail is a big time currency among the elite. You know, it's how they, it's how people are kept in line. They get dirt on somebody, or maybe they help, they push somebody to do something. You know, maybe this is where a use that they make of, you know, the child sex trafficking. You know, they possibly get people to do things, you know, to initiate them into, the, you know, the group, the power mongering group, and then they have something to hold over them. And it seemed like Larry King was somebody who nobody knew exactly who he was or why he had this kind of power, but he did, and he turned out to be the one who was at the epicenter of what was apparently, you know, a child sex trafficking ring where they were taking kids, mostly boys, from Boys Town and other places. You know, kids who didn't really have much of a family, foster kids who didn't really have people to stick up for them, and pimping them out. And he was at the epicenter of it all. And it seems like, although nothing has been proven about James Alefantis, and I'm not here accusing him of being a child sex trafficker because I don't know. I think his Instagram posts suggest that he is a, you know, somebody who I would not want to live around. I'll just say that.
Yeah, or someone who thinks that child trafficking is an appropriate subject for humor.
Yeah, is funny, and it's okay to just post it in
public.
He got all self-righteous. It really pissed me off. He got all self-righteous in one interview about how people were taking pictures from his Instagram page of children, and how terrible that was. And these were pictures that he had put up on his Instagram page, mm-hmm. and it was a public Instagram page. So it's not like they were hacking into some private, you know, place that he didn't want everybody to see. This was on his. This was something that everybody could see just by going to the Comet Ping Pong Instagram page.
Yeah, it was WikiLeaks that got someone's attention, then he went to Instagram, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so it seems like Alefantis is sort of the analog for what Larry King was to the Franklin scandal. And if you'll remember, in the Franklin scandal, the press covered it up as well. There was there's a D.C. connection involving, what was his name, Craig Spence?
Craig Spence, who was a GOP lobbyist, yeah.
Right, and
which Tony Podesta, lobbyist. There you go.
Yeah, exactly, and the Washington Post also played a role, because it was actually the Washington Times.
Yeah, they ran it.
They ran an expose, and then the Post tried to say, no, this isn't really happening, and they sort of said, oh well, Craig Spence, the Washington Times article said that he was recording all these, that he had this house bugged, and that he had, you know, children that he kept in the basement, and that, you know, became a sex party later at night, and they were trying to debunk all of this. And so they were sort of complicit in this cover up at the behest of the establishment. And it seems that that's also what's happening with the Washington Post and other mainstream sources with regard to Pizzagate. Now, I mean,
they do this, all these stories. The Post and the LA Times, even the New York Times, played that role with Gary Webb. Right?
I don't know that case as well, but I know he's the one who investigated the CIA connections to crack cocaine.
Yeah,
right?
But they put a whole battalion of reporters to, you know, deconstruct his life. They exposed the affair he had, ruin his career, run him out of the business.
Yeah,
and people like Walter Pincus, this political reporter for the Washington Post, wrote a story, wrote a story lambasting him as being reckless. Turns out that Pincus was a longtime Mockingbird reporter on the CIA payroll.
Yeah, right. You know? I mean, it's the Mockingbird media. That's pretty much pretty much what they are, and they've truly, you know, I mean, I think the WikiLeaks files really exposed them big time.
And hear about Jake Tapper, rather.
Oh yeah, sure.
Uh-huh. His wife apparently is a big fan of Comet Ping Pong.
That's what I heard somewhere. Maybe, yeah. maybe I was listening to a prior interview that somebody did with you where that was mentioned.
It wasn't I heard about it. Apparently, it's among the WikiLeaks or something. And that goes to a point with Wayne Mattson. Wayne Mattson, who has done a lot of reporting on pedophilia, sex rings in D.C., and how the political establishment is co-opted by it. But not just the political – what it means by the political establishment also means the media. Like a lot of the big co-anchors we see, the reporters, the people we see in television go to these parties and are compromised, which is why they won't look up for it. You know?
Yes, and it does boggle – it boggles the mind. And this is not something that, you know, I would have like – 2 or 3 years ago, I wouldn't have believed all of this. I had a really eye-opening moment when I was studying the Franklin scandal, and I think I talked about it last time. And it was, and all of a sudden, it just crept up on me, just the horror of it all, and I couldn't shake it. Like I was like for, you know, four weeks, I was in a funk just thinking about it. I didn't want it to be true.
But, I mean, this is how – I mean, look at what we found out with Fox News and Roger Ailes, right? And some of the trouble he got in with so-called sexual harassment. Now, I don't know if that's really sexual harassment. It's just more or less the casting couch. These girls, they want to get in the media, and what you got to do to get in the media is you got to pay your dues. And that's just the reality of the business. The same thing out in Hollywood, by the way.
Yep.
And they can, you know, and it can get more predatorial because you can involve children. And if you're involving adults, you can say, well, there's some – they're mature, they're big girls.
Yeah.
They make that decision.
Making their own minds, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm saying it goes to the nature of the press, the media.
Yeah.
And you can see if whether you're – let's say you're your typical egotistical politician who are – large appetites and some say are slaves to their passions.
Right.
It's very easy to cater to that with a lot of, if not willing, available young girls and boys.
Yes.
And you get into that world and all of a sudden you find yourself, you get used to that.
That's the new normal now.
That's the new normal for you. But if say someone from the outside exposes this and wants to report on the scandal, you're going to close ranks and protect that. This little world you live in,
and it's not even about Democrats versus Republicans. And that, like the Post, which gets would get accused of being as a liberal, you know, a liberal paper. They went all out to try to show that the Franklin scandal was there was nothing to it, and that was mostly a scandal that involved Republicans, including, I believe, George H.W. Bush, that he was, you know. According to a couple people, you know, had connections to things, to unsavory things.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same way that the George W. Bush Justice Department helped cover up the Epstein thing.
Right.
They're the ones that negotiated the plea deal.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, they close ranks. They're ultimately, it's not about Democrats versus Republicans. It's about them. It's again, it's about the powerful. The sociopathic, powerful, the reptilians versus the normal people who, you know, believe me, I'm not saying that normal people are necessarily great. We're all capable of evil, but it seems like, you know, again, that was the source of, if you want to call it fascination or intrigue.
Well, I think normal people are grounded or limited by their circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, this is why the middle class is sort of the backbone of society, because they're wealthy enough and stable enough to provide a decent life for their family and not to be desperate, but at the same time, they're not wealthy enough to indulge in a deviant lifestyle without having immediate effect.
Maybe it's the case that it's a sort of you become that way slowly through getting more and more power. I mean, it's sort of a cliche thing, like you see in a...
A billionaire never hears the word no.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. And maybe on your way to being a becoming a billionaire, you become more and more, becoming a powerful figure, you become more and more inured to getting what you want, or more and more used to getting what you want, and the same thing for, you know, becoming any kind of, you know, star in Hollywood or wherever,
but you become a de facto Satanist because you become a narcissist.
Yeah, whether exactly. And you see all these. I mean, I used to think it was funny. I mean, I think about how all these kids. I feel kind of ashamed about this now. But I remember a few years ago, you know, thinking about. I remember what was her name, Dana Plato, who was on Different Strokes. How she just totally went off the rails, and I think maybe died of an overdose or something. Died in some really unsavory way, but was just totally you know, we see the same kind of circumstance or the same kind of pattern coming out of Hollywood with more and more, you know, again and again and again, with young people who are brought into this scene at a young age. I mean, you think of Britney Spears or Lindsay Lohan or whatever; those are the more prominent examples, but also, you know, people like the kid, I don't even remember his name, but the kid who played Anakin Skywalker in The Phantom Menace, apparently same thing, you know, the Coreys, Corey Hyman, Corey Feldman, who I mentioned earlier. It just seems like this, there's something really evil about Hollywood in that it just wrecks people, and especially the young and vulnerable. They go there and then they do things to them and just mess them up, and they're never the same. And you know, they show signs of abuse, you know, signs of having. I'm sure some of it's just the narcissism that we talked about earlier, of, you know, becoming a star you know, that makes you insufferable to a degree. But they also show signs of psychosis and you know, just. I mean, they just lose their minds. Look at, what's her name? Miley Cyrus. Mm-hmm. Look at what she's become. I mean, and again, I used to look at cases like this and just think that it was kind of funny. And I'm not saying don't laugh. I'm not the joke police here. But it's only struck me recently just how it's really these kinds of, like, Hollywood and these other power centers are just, you know, they do things to people. And
yeah, it's not just a question of living life in the limelight or life, you know, life on stage. It's almost like there is a system that's designed to corrupt them, use them, you know, consume these kids and spit them out. It's just satanic.
It's worse than just getting a lot of acclaim and then forgetting where you came from, and, you know, I'm that happens too, but it seems like there's a component to it that's much worse than that, and that's why I want to tie that back to Pizzagate quickly if we can, because there's some like I'd noticed, and there are places where they talk about this on YouTube and elsewhere, like things like Macaulay Culkin, the Home Alone kid.
He's a band. Yeah,
he's in a band called the Pizza Underground, and this was something that they started. It was like 3 or 4 years ago. There was at first there was a video that he put up where it was just him eating a slice of pizza, not saying anything, but just eating a slice of pizza. And then the Pizza Underground, which is like a parody band of the Velvet Underground, where they do Velvet Underground songs but change the lyrics to make them about pizza. And again, just like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it would have just seemed like a dumb joke.
Did you see the video with the two twins from Full House?
No. Is there something pizza related there?
Yes. There's a pizza, everything on the pizza, these little girls singing about pizza and raiding the refrigerator and putting everything on the pizza. Cheese and cake, and you can find it on YouTube. It's real annoying, but they're, you know, the Olsen twins, and it's pizza, and
which wouldn't, I mean, you wouldn't think anything of it at the time,
yeah.
Miley Cyrus, I mentioned her, is obsessed with pizza and, you know, and has a pizza bedspread or something. And I mean, again, some of this is kind of out there and it seems tenuous. And I don't, you know, I don't want to be credulous and just believe everything, anything that's, anytime anybody mentions pizza, that that means something evil and sinister. But you notice things like this. And then, you know, Katy Perry, there's something that where, you know, the a song that she had like 3 or 4 years ago, This Is What We Do. And there was there's a video that where they talk about the video that was made for this song where they have, you know, pizza slices dancing around and she's wearing a pizza bathing suit in one scene. And there's a part of the song where they say, it's no big deal. It's no big deal. And it's like, it's no big deal. This is what we do. And this was before Pizzagate broke, but again, we have somebody who went into showbiz at a young age. And, I don't, she hasn't showed signs of going quite as off the rails as some of them, but still this, they're, are they trying to tell us something? You can't help but wonder. And, you know, this video that I saw was breaking it down and sort of saying like, you know, there was also a ping pong table. There was a ping pong table in this video as well. And the whole, it's no big deal. It's kind of strange in the song when you listen to it. The song is just about partying and living it up and, you know, and seems kind of innocuous. But this part where she's saying it's no big deal, it's no big deal, it's kind of strange. It sounds kind of defensive, like, you know, you might think it's a big deal, but it's not. And that, you know, is she really saying that in the sectors of the Hollywood elite and the I don't know, the elite in general, pedophilia is no big deal? I mean, again, I'll send you the link to that. But there's all these kinds of things, and I didn't even know about the Olsen twins thing. And you wouldn't think twice about it, you know, just a little while ago. But now it's, you know, with what we're learning about the pizza code, it just makes you wonder how deep this rabbit hole goes, you know, the breadth and depth of it all.
Well, again, what we're dealing with here again is we've been presented with enough circumstantial evidence, I think, which in any other situation would justify an official investigation, a warrant being served, some mm-hmm. searching being done. But the problem is we really can't depend on the constituted authorities, the official channels to investigate these things, because judging from the Franken scandal, judging from the Finders case, the Presidio, these things get quashed because they open a can of worms. They expose so much. So, mm-hmm. Again, but this does – what it does, it gives us a sort of a glimpse into the deviant world of the ruling class, of the political elite. And they really are a separate class.
Yes, they are a separate class, and they are in some ways just alien to the rest of us. I mean, I still think that DNA-wise they are human, but I don't know. There's something different about them, and maybe – you know, I know there's a certain percentage of people who are sociopathic just by nature, and I don't know if anybody knows, you know, the just like with homosexuality, I don't know if the actual percentage is really known. You know, you hear some political groups try to inflate it, or others say no, it's not so much, but
well,
so there's.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can alter conditions. You can create sexual confusion, dysfunction,
sure,
just by creating a toxic environment.
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, they have
abuse,
the levers of power.
Yeah.
And they can get to people.
And I think, like I said, when I said earlier that they rely on destabilizing certain regions to facilitate the human trafficking, the drug trafficking, the same can apply domestically, too, with promoting policies that lead to family dysfunction and breakup. You create higher incidences of homosexualities, higher incidences of abuse, trauma, which lead to sexual confusion and homosexuality. I know there's a case you're from Georgia, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And the case of that state senator down there, Schaefer.
Yeah, Nancy Schaefer.
Nancy Schaefer was investigating the corruption at the Child Protective Services. There is a law, I think that was passed in 1974, I think it was shepherded by Senator Walter Mondale, called the Safe Families – oh, what is that? I've got my notes here. Yeah, it's Senator Nancy Schaefer. She was killed in 2010 and reported – murder-suicide with her husband. She was investigating the CPS and its involvement in child trafficking. She issued a report called The Corrupt Business of the CPS, and basically CPS case officers were given $4,000, $6,000 bonus for each child that was removed from a family, put into foster care, then subsequently adopted. And from that, I think she suspected a child trafficking operation going on.
Right.
And she says it derived from the Adoption and Safe Families Act of 1974, which was sponsored by Senator Walter Mondale and was expanded by Bill Clinton in 1997. The act offered cash bonuses to the states for every child adopted out of foster care. So in order to get more cash, local CPS needed to get more children, and they started to seize children from families, create cases, create pretexts to take kids, put them into foster care, and then more or less sell them off to an adopted family.
Yeah.
And of course, then she's investigating this and she dies in this murder-suicide.
Wasn't she also investigating whether they were ultimately being sent to pedophiles?
Yes.
Was that a component of it?
Yeah, it was a component. That's what I meant. It was a pipeline, the pedophiles. And they were almost like there were requests for certain types of children that were being put. Given to the CPS, so they would profile kids and then target them.
Yeah,
and so that's how corrupt it is. Now, there's been various reports or suspicions raised against various child protective services throughout the states, and this type of agency would be ripe for being infiltrated, being utilized by this reptilian class or agents for them.
Yeah.
Because the bureaucratic structure is there to legally kidnap kids, and they're targeting families of very limited resources.
I heard an interview with on what's the thing called out of the Brian Gerrish out of the UK. Do you know that show?
Not a fan. No.
Okay, it's I can't think of the name of the show right now, but Brian Gerrish is a commentator, and he interviewed a couple in Scotland who basically had their kids taken from them after somebody came to their door and offered to give them cash so that if he could have access to their disabled son. And he said, this family said, of course, no, go away. And they reported him. And then the authorities ended up turning on the family, turning on the parents and taking their kids away. Just a horrific kind of story. I'll find the link for that, too. Mm. But it's an example of just what seems to be this broad, widespread corruption. And, of course, I guess we should probably draw things to a close pretty soon, but I don't know if we can kind of go on forever, unfortunately. But it causes me to think about what sort of people are into this kind of thing. I mean, if you made me a multimillionaire, I'm still not going to want to have sex with children. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So what happens? I mean, is it must be, I guess what it comes down to is that it must be something about thriving on having power and getting to, that there must be some kind of thrill that is obtained from doing the worst possible things to the most defenseless and innocent of people, you know, namely children. I mean, there must be just trying to strip the emotion from it, which isn't easy to do. But if you just try to look at it analytically, what makes people like this gravitate to activities like this? And it just must have something to do with the power, the getting off on the power and getting off on being able to transgress the moral law so thoroughgoingly that you know, there's just you really can't get much worse than that. And
yeah.
And it must be an outgrowth of self deification.
Yeah, which just goes back to Satanism, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the ultimate inversion of things, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is a central tenet of Satanism, I think, is inversion, transvaluation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's some more disturbing things that I've read. No proof, but it is that if the addiction of adrenaline, that when you take an animal, let's call a child an animal in a sense, and you torture them, there's adrenaline that's pumped into the blood. And some people have suggested that people use the blood with adrenaline in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's,
yeah,
you know, that's really creepy. But there's something to get life from that.
Yeah.
Abramovic character who's supposedly 70 years old and looks like she's more like 40.
Right, yeah.
Judging from the photographs, I don't know what to make of that. Maybe she isn't 70. I just heard she turned 70 in 1940. She'll be 70 the next year.
Yeah.
Judging from the official records, and whether that's not true, she does not look anywhere near 70. She looks more like 40.
No, I know. I've noticed the same thing.
Yeah, I remember.
And she's out there hobnobbing with politicians and rap stars and what have you.
Yeah, and you know, and I remember. Remember John Judge, the Kennedy researcher,
No, I don't think so. Not offhand.
Yeah, well, he did a thing. I'm talking about the Atlanta child killings. Remember back in 1980?
Oh yeah, sure. I was in Atlanta. I mean, I was in Metro Atlanta, so I remember that well.
And if you look at that story, it seems like that was kind of he was a fall guy.
Wayne Williams. When they arrested, you mean?
Yeah. There is some suspicion there that these kids were being harvested for interferon, and it was part of a. He said it was part of a sort of a military psyop or operation or experiment or something. Mm. And so you get that angle. I don't know. It's you know, I mean,
sounds really out there, but
it's
but
out there.
You never know.
If you have international markets for organs for kids from wars, another thing that the war zones provide is when you have displaced people, children, you can get children who can be harvested for organs. And you hear reports about that. And to me, if you're out there selling, you know, whether Planned Parenthood selling baby parts or harvesting organs, this isn't too far of a stretch to be engaged in this sort of thing. Hello?
Yeah. Well, I think that a culture that tolerates abortion on the scale that our culture does, I mean, the whole about abortion is, if you look at it really for what it really is, and it's hard to avoid an awareness of some moral culpability there. And, you know, if that can happen, and it is happening every day, perfectly legally, then, you know, I think it shows the kind of Pandora's box that's you know, letting loose all kinds of other things that, I don't know, maybe these kind of things have been happening for decades or maybe even for centuries. Who knows?
I mean, well, yeah, that's one of the things. One thing is the overall sexualization of children, which has occurred in the mainstream.
Yes.
Right? And with entertainment and all that, with and Disney and the media companies, movies are all, music industry is all involved in that. But I've listened to a comment a few weeks ago regarding Pizzagate in on the Hoaxbusters call, and the guest said, "We live in a world where 50 million babies are aborted every year. Shouldn't you be surprised by this?"
Yeah.
Going to your remark, you know.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I guess that, I mean, you can, somebody could respond to this by saying that, oh, well, in ancient Sparta, they left newborns to die and and so forth. I think that there might be something more, more terrifying about a culture that has the truth in its fullness and then falls away from it, which from a, you know, a Christian point of view, if you are a Christian believer, that's what the West used to be. That's what the, you know, the United States used to be. And the secularization effect might be, you know, the fact that we, you know, we had the truth and it's in the fullness of its revelation, and then apostatized. And there's something about the apostate that is, you know, in some way worse than the one who never had the opportunity to believe.
Yeah, you can't plead ignorance.
Right, well, yeah, and with the ancient pagans, you know, living in Sparta. I mean, I'm not saying that they aren't culpable for child murder, but maybe in a way they are less culpable than we are for, you know, since we could be talked about the West in general, which, you know, used to be what was called Christendom, has fallen away. And, you know, maybe that, again, this is just me going out on a limb and speculating, but maybe that's part of the whole mega trend that has led us to down this, you know, into this pit of darkness that we're in now.
And that's one of the concerns, maybe close this out on a thought, close the interview out on this thought, is that these scandals, they're exposed and they get out into the public, but when nothing is done about them, there's a degrading effect. Good example was the Clinton Lewinsky scandal, where all this, because of Clinton's dissembling and word games and perjury, and Star published this report that in excruciating detail about, you know, fellatio and what they did, what sex was, and all that stuff. So it became something that was discussed publicly, right? These things.
Yeah.
Pretty soon, they were discussing this on the news. They were discussed about in schools, and this stuff usually wasn't something that you talked about in public. It was discussed. It became, you know, a public debate, and society was that much more degraded because of it.
Yeah.
There are even some studies to show that because of that, you know, middle schoolers, there was a significant increase in oral sex among middle schoolers.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, society is degraded, and this is part of that revelation of the method that Michael Hoffman talks about, that these scandals,
or problem reaction solution, almost
the idea is to get this out there and just degrade, lower public morality that much more, degrade the public that much more.
In that sense, that we had Clinton and Starr working in tandem, in a way,
more or less,
yeah,
and that was the the effect of that, So when these things come out, and there's been a gradual normalization of pedophilia, and, you know, it's probably since NABLA was formed, and you've had that goes in tandem with the gay rights movement. And they have to accept some responsibility. I know that, you know, people will make this distinction, and there is an important distinction to be made, but nevertheless, activists like Harry Hay, you know, they were always advocates of pedophilia.
Or Harvey Milk, right? Didn't he take in some 15, 16-year-old runaway?
Yeah. Yeah, so
and have sex with him, and
All and he's thought of as a hero, and there's a road sign named after him now.
And someone pointed out that the avatar for James Olifantis on his Instagram was this boy lover of the Emperor Hadrian,
right?
Antonius, I think, is his name.
Yes, that's right.
So what is he invoking there? I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, and so this, and not like I alluded to earlier, is the normalization of sex, not just entertainment, but also with things like, you know, sex education, so-called age education, on the pretext of a public health measure. They started to discuss all these graphic sex matters with adolescents.
It does seem to center around sex somehow. I know E. Michael Jones, who I know you've spoken with a few times. I know that's a big thing for him in his book, Libido Dominandi.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very, very interesting and very thought provoking and sounded pretty accurate.
If you become a slave to your passions and your appetites, become enslaved to whoever who can satisfy those passion and appetites. And that's kind of like the story of, reminded of the story of Pinocchio, where you go to Pleasure Island, right? And then you're thrown into the salt mines. You're enslaved.
That's right. That's how you can enslave a populace by teaching them not to control themselves.
And people who can't control themselves have no sense for deferred gratification, have no sense for posterity. And I was just thinking about this thing. It's almost like that there's sex, and then there's also corrupted sex. There's also corrupted money. How through debt you can create by penalizing savings and subsidizing consumption through debt, you create a contempt for posterity. People have no reason to save for the future, to think about the future. Same thing when it comes to easy sex, easy money, easy sex. The two go hand in hand. Look at the Weimar Republic. Mm-hmm. You know?
Interesting.
That's why the sodomy in Dante's Inferno, the sodomites and the usurers share the same level of hell. Uh-huh. There's some insight there.
Yeah, definitely.
And so that's what's happening. I mean, that's, you know, and again, if you're not interested, if you're interested only about your short-term pleasure, live for the day, that is ultimately a message of death, because you're not thinking about your offspring. And we're all kind of entrapped in that. You don't realize you yourself have been experimented on.
Yeah.
Through your life, we're all damaged goods, you know.
Right, we're all products of the media to one extent or other. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
products
and,
of our and who's of the blame? Ruling I mean, class.
I mean, I did an interview with Dr. Michael Jones a while back regarding, it came up, the movie Spotlight, about the church pedophilia scandal.
Right.
It's the sex scandals. And in that movie, they blame everything on the insular Catholic Church and the Catholic community. Actually, it's the quite opposite. It's the Boston Globe is a big advocate of the very priests who are engaged in these acts because of their innovative youth outreach.
Right.
It was the liberal priest and the liberal diocese who got in all the trouble. But at the same time, it's papers like the Boston Globe, Hollywood, Madison Avenue, Entertainment, promoting libertine sexual values, and they act shocked when the church isn't immune to the poisoning of the societal well that the church draws from. You know, there's some, you know, I'm not excusing the church officials for the mistakes they made or the corruption they were involved in, the cover-ups or even what they're, in some cases, actually doing. But the same token, you can't excuse the cultural mandarins, those who make popular culture that was designed to corrupt the values of the society. And then, then shocked when you see the poison fruit of your efforts, you know. So anyway. But.
Yeah, exactly. And just to add to that, one more component they're big on exposés of the Catholic Church and its corruption, and there are plenty of instances of corruption within the church today, unfortunately. But I thought it was very interesting that this woman, I'm not remembering her first name right now, but her last name is Berg. And she did a movie about sex scandals in the church that was very well received and acclaimed. And then she did a movie about about pedophilia in Hollywood. And we talked about it on the Boiler Room about a month and a half ago. And that film just sort of didn't go anywhere, had very limited release, and eventually wound up on YouTube. Like, you can watch the whole thing on YouTube now, which is, I mean, it didn't even go to Netflix, you know.
Is that Open Secret?
An Open Secret, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the church should be called the task for the corruption that is within it. But it is interesting how it makes sense that Hollywood really wouldn't like to hear a movie about how corrupt and depraved, or taking Hollywood to task for how corrupt and depraved Hollywood is. But that tells you something. I mean, that tells you who's taking orders from whom, or who's really in control right now in a worldly sense. And I would just say, you know, I'm Catholic. I'm an observant Catholic. I struggle sometimes in my faith, but I have to say that, you know, when the more I regard all of this darkness that's out there, the more I see the necessity of faith. And I can't understand, you know, I have nothing against people who are atheist or agnostic just for being atheist or agnostic, but I don't understand how it's possible to cope knowing what the world is. And the deeper you look, the worse and worse it gets. So just kind of what has struck me lately, especially looking at all this stuff that I somehow feel compelled to look at, even though, I mean, there's a kind of sick fascination with it. But at the same time, you know, it can really sneak up and bite you psychically. And I've experienced that a couple of times. So yeah. So it's dark stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But, someone once said, all evil needs to succeed is for good men to do nothing. And at the bottom line is, at least from a practical standpoint, if you think children are being victimized, you have to do something to try to stop, at least expose it. And
that's what I said, you know, my latest podcast about Pizzagate. Just not that I believe that anything will happen, you know, from the institutions of supposed law and order, because they, you know, I think that on a high level, they are obviously very corrupt and complicit in these kinds of evils. They cover up for them when they protect the powerful. They close ranks around the powerful and leave the innocent hung out to dry. But there is something. But it's not. I'm not being entirely like, there's nothing you can do about it. The powerful control everything, and they're not going to do anything. So it's all going to just keep repeating and you're powerless to change it. No, I don't think that's the case at all, but you have to understand who they are and understand that they are not interested in protecting you, and they're not interested in protecting your loved ones, and, you know, not to be paranoid, but to take precautions, to take the proper steps to protect yourself and your loved ones, and also to do what you can to protect the innocent in a more general sense.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, that's what we're called to do.
Yeah. And also exposing and raising consciousness, because if you raise consciousness, you may not get the satisfaction of an official inquiry, investigation, conviction, but to the extent that you inhibit them, you reduce the number of victims.
That's right. If you can help people open their eyes to it,
just like those two girls that were saved from Marc Dutroux's dungeon in Belgium, obviously, the full network wasn't exposed and he was the fall guy in that case. But at the end of the day, there are two girls because someone kept investigating. They were saved, whose lives were saved.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're alive today because of that. So,
and maybe you know. At some point, I mean, I'm not a populist, but and so I don't usually do much with populist type rhetoric, but maybe, you know, if you can open people's eyes or help people to see things, put things out there and help people to see or you know, to people who are good at heart and who want the right, want to see truth prevail and want to see good prevail over evil. Maybe at some point it does reach a critical mass where, I mean, right now they have to, with Pizzagate, they have to mock it on, you know, primetime or late night TV shows where there's a bunch of people watching because they know that because of the internet, it's growing and people are becoming aware of it. And so they would rather just nip it in the bud and not have it be talked about at all. But it's gotten out of their control, at least to some extent. And that's a good thing. And, you know, we should try to push things more in that direction.
Yeah, because it's a vast network, and we're getting a glimpse into the whole criminal syndicate that operates the world. That's what the Clinton Foundation is, and and Clintons are wired into this whole network of drugs, illegal arms, human trafficking, warfare, you know, profit, you know, making money through human suffering and exploitation, which is the global system we live under right now. So, you know, this is just one peek into it.
Yep.
So, well, listen, Andy, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me this evening.
Yes, it's been a good conversation. I've enjoyed it.
And not a cheerful, but I think a necessary.
No, well, maybe I shouldn't say enjoyed it, but it's been an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
I'm glad we've had it.
Yeah, these things are therapy for me. So.
Yes, they are. They are.
So they great. Are. And, Chris, you're the Nameless Podcast?
Yes, I have the Nameless Podcast. I do. I contribute articles to. I'm the assistant editor. I used to be the co-editor, but now I'm the assistant editor of AlternativeRight. Blogspot.com, and I have my own solo podcast. I do the Nameless Podcast. I'm also on the Boiler Room with Alternate Current Radio. Usually on a weekly basis. I had to miss it this week, but. And I write articles for Alternative Right, and I've got my book, Conspiracy, Compliance, Control, and Defiance, where I go into a little bit more detail about some of this stuff. I published it earlier this year, and I've got some other books also. If anyone is interested, just look me up on Amazon.
Okay, great. Listen, I'll let you go for the night, and I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas to you as well, Tim. Thank you again for letting me be your guest.
Well, thank you for coming on, and good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
With tender hands, you gathered up pieces of my life, lying in your loving arms, never felt so right. The hard luck road behind me is reflected in your eyes. The glory of the bright lights can't compare to this feeling when you smile. You're the good things I threw away, coming back to me every day. You're the best it could ever be. You are what love means. From the bottom to the top, I can tell you now, I'm thankful for what I've got. These prison walls inside me never let this poor soul free. Till the power of your true love broke them down just in time to rescue me. You're the song I could never write. You're the magic in my heart tonight. When the morning sun comes shining through, I'll still be holding you. You're the good things I threw away, coming back to me. You're the best it could ever be. You are what love means to me. Things I threw away, coming back to me every day. You're the best it could ever be. You are what love means to me. You're the best it could.